bit of purport to go through,
and the verse is not written. I'll just chant the sloka, and then we'll just go through like that. So I'll chant the sloka for text number 18. Udaram upasate yadi shivaram asukarupatishaha parisara pradatim hidayam varunayadaharam tathau urgaranandatavadhamasira paramam punarihayat samichana patanti kritanta makhe.
So first, continuing with the purport to text number 17, and I'll just read the translation of that verse again. Only if they become your faithful followers are those who breathe actually alive. Otherwise their breathing is like that of a bellows. It is by your mercy alone that the elements, beginning with the Mahatattva and false ego, created the egg of this universe. Among the manifestations known as Anamaya and so forth, you are the ultimate one. Entering within the material coverings along with the living entity and assuming the same forms as those he takes, distinct from the gross and subtle material manifestations, you are the reality underlying them all. Now, in that purport there, the part that you would have heard there is describing how one who does not take to Krishna consciousness, although they're showing symptoms of life, they're considered to be as good as dead. Right? That would have been the mood of that. And then it finished up with describing how Mahavishnu enters within the universe, and it is because he enters within the universe that all the various material manifestations become manifest, and which brings us up to where we are now. Now, of course, if you join those two points, as Srila Prabhupada often does for us, when we can't see the relationship, Srila Prabhupada expresses in the Krishna book that, in very simple terms, because we are living by the mercy of the Lord, because Mahavishnu entered within the universe, literally whatever facility we have is by the mercy of the Lord, therefore one who does not worship the Lord is literally, you know, they have no real valuable consciousness, they're as good as dead, and they are living in vain. So that is the connection. Now, the next part of that verse is describing how Mahavishnu is the underlying principle of all reality, or, you know, Krishna in his expansion is Mahavishnu, but the Lord is the underlying principle of all reality. So just recapping the verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam so far in the from the Vedas personified, they are describing from text 14 to text 41, there are 28 principal shrutis who are describing the essence of all Vedic knowledge, of which those who are prominent among those shrutis in these verses particularly glorify the Lord in devotional service. But those shrutis are also describing how the Lord has unlimited qualities, of which the foremost is his mercy upon the conditioned souls by delivering them from the clutches of Maya. And because of that merciful attitude towards the Lord, he has actually presented them with Vedic knowledge by which, even in their conditioned state, they can use their mind and senses and intelligence according to their particular position to make progress
toward the transcendental position and ultimately go back home, back to Godhead. So that's the mood of all these prayers. In the next verse, text 15, it was describing how it appeared that in the Vedas, sometimes various other demigods appear to be worshipped. And as supreme, even. And therefore this can be a little confusing, but in that verse it clarified that just as whether one stands on mud or stones or brick, whatever one is standing on, ultimately one is standing on the earth. So even though in one sense everything is in connection with Brahman, the Supreme Brahman, and therefore in that sense we can sometimes the demigods are worshipped or approached as a means of approaching the Supreme Lord. In the same way, even though we're walking on the earth, sometimes we walk on bricks, sometimes we walk on stones, but we're still walking on the earth. That's our purpose. But for those who don't understand the teachings of the Vedas, they foolishly think that sometimes if a demigod is offered worship as being supreme, that means that that demigod is the cause of all causes. The other day I was having a discussion with someone in membership services, and poor Ursula couldn't hear herself on the phone, but I happened to come across a couple of Mayavadis who wanted to have a who wanted to do a battle of wits. You could see a little smirk on the face. It was two boys, and you could see one was, you could tell by the looks on their faces, like, let's get him, you know, because I'd just given a Sunday feast class and I described that Krishna as supreme, not Shiva, not Brahma. So they wanted to tackle me on that. So he was saying that in the Ramayana, Lord Ram worships Shiva as supreme, which he does. He offers worship to Lord Shiva, and this is very confusing. So I explained to him that, but who is the Ramayana glorifying ultimately? Right? We all know the Ramayana is the glories of Lord Ram. He is the central figure of glorification and worship. Even though he, you know, on one occasion there's some worship offered to Shiva, that doesn't, to take the whole attention off the Ramayana from Ram to Shiva is a total, you've missed the whole book. But, of course, you know, if we look at the pastimes of Ramayana, he was portraying the perfect king. And therefore he worshipped his father. He worshipped his mother. And of course he would worship respectful demigods. He worshipped saints and sages. He worshipped everyone, appropriately, as a king should do. It's not that he would, you know, disrespect anyone. Everyone was worshipped according to their position. And Lord Shiva is non-different from Vishnu. He is actually a guna avatar. But he's in a special category, as is understood from the Brahma Samhita, that there are two manifestations of Vishnu Tattva. One, which is in the superior sense, has no connection with the material energy, and the other has some connection. Lord Shiva is in that category, Vishnu Tattva. But there is some connection with the material energy. So this is described very elaborately throughout the Vedic scriptures. And as we know, in the Shiva Purana, Padma Purana, Lord Shiva, he describes himself in the Vedic literatures that of all worship, there's worship of so many demigods, there's worship of me, there's so much worship. But of all worship, worship of Lord Vishnu is the highest. He says that himself. Vishnu is supreme.
He himself, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we know he meditates upon Mahasankirtan. And of course he says that even above the worship of Lord Vishnu is the worship of Vishnu's devotees. So, in this way, we're trying to explain, but I won't go on with the whole conversation, but at one stage I actually asked him, do you think you're God? And the reply was yes. Now that took me back because I thought he'd certainly say no, you know. But he actually said yes. I thought maybe he's not understood the question. So I asked him again, you think you're God? Yes. Straight out. And he was deadly serious. So they... anyway. This is the sort of... there are statements in the Vedas, but the Vedas are saying that the essential essence of everything is Brahman, which manifests as the Brahma Jyoti, the Paramatma, and Bhagavan. They're the three features of Brahman, which are described in the Vedas, and that Brahman. From Brahman rests everything, spiritual and material, just as, and it is the essence of everything, and then there are various transformations of Brahman, such as the material manifestation. In the same way that you may take clay, and then you have so many different things that you can make from the clay, so many manifestations. So there is the essential, basically, although you may have a clay pot and a clay cup and a clay spoon and a clay head and a clay this and a clay that, what you really got there is clay. And apart from a whole lot of different names and shapes, you've really just got clay. See? So, you know, the Vedas are saying that ultimately... the essential substance is Brahman, and all the various transformations are one with the Supreme in that they are all transformations of Brahman, or Brahman in its original feature. So that Vishnu and Krishna, the Brahma Jyoti, that is Brahman. And demigods, even to the point of Shiva, they are the various manifestations from Brahman. So then it described that therefore intelligent people, they worship Brahman, that which is actually described in the Vedas as the worshipable object, either in its impersonal features, Brahma Jyoti, or in the Paramatma feature, or in the Bhagavan feature, but what the Vedas are directing us to worship is Brahman. That is the original essence of everything. And when there is, the Vedas direct our attentions to such personalities as Shiva or Brahma, that is secondary worship, that is a secondary attention is being paid. So the Vedas do direct us, because there are manifestations from Brahman, so they will direct us that there is some worship and respect to the various transformations of Brahman, but it is in a secondary sense. Whereas the primary worship is to the original Brahman itself, and the topmost feature of Brahman is Parabrahman, which is Lord Sri Krishna. So then those who are really elevated souls, of course they worship Lord Sri Krishna. And they completely absorb themselves in the pastimes of Krishna in the spiritual world, and they're actually connoisseurs, as it's described, connoisseurs of, you know, the relishing spiritual ecstasy. So then it describes that those who don't do this, those who don't follow that Vedic process of worshipping
Brahman, Parabrahman, Paramatma, and instead they direct their attention elsewhere, they're considered to be very foolish, and they're really, although they have the symptoms of life, they're as good as, they're just like the bellows of a blacksmith, although air is pumping through them. It's different to one who is actually living, fully conscious, and enjoying life. So that brings us up to this particular point in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and in this verse here, in this purport, it describes that as is described here. That among the manifestations known as Anamaya and so forth, you are the ultimate one. Right. So the purport is quite lengthy, but I can give you the essence of it if you like. That there are five different manifestations of Brahman called Pancham, there's a word, two words. Sure, if it's in this purport. I know it's in the purport to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, text number 2. I mean. But it's something like Pancha Brahman, some words like that. It's not quite that. But there are five different manifestations of Brahman: Anamaya, Pranamaya, Manamaya, which is also sometimes called Jnanamaya, Vijnanamaya, and Anandamaya. So actually in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 13th chapter, these things are also taken up, because where Krishna describes to Arjuna that there are two types of knowers in the body, Kshetrajna. So one type of knower is the Vijnanamaya, who is the spirit soul. And another type of knower is a Paramatma, who is an Anandamaya. They are distinct. And the field of activities is Pranamaya, Anamaya, Pranamaya, and Manamaya. the Anamaya is where there is consciousness that in order to exist, one must eat. So you can imagine how many, that is existence, that is the sum and substance of reality for a lot of living entities. Right? And what are they enjoying? Anyone on that platform, down to the little ant who's eating something and they're looking, here's food, even to the humans who have this very, they're very materialistic, very short-sighted, they have this consciousness, oh, this is something to eat. You see, sometimes I've been with people and you're driving in a car and you look out into the fields and you'll see some sheep, and they will make a comment, that'd be nice on the dinner plate or something like that. They see everything as food, potential food. And depending on the culture as well, some cultures are worse than others. There was one person, I won't say what race he came from, but I asked him, I said, you know, what did you used to eat before you were a devotee? He said, anything that moved. He was serious. So that is anamaya. They're enjoying something in life. They're enjoying, that is their reality. And what is their that is their enjoyment. That entire existence is a manifestation of Brahman on its lowest level. It is actually Brahman. So from there, of course, you have pranamayi, which is a slightly more elevated position, which when we eat, of course, it manifests various symptoms of life. Mobility, activity, and on a slightly higher level, people, generally humans, they begin to appreciate the value of life. And there is a certain enjoyment. For instance, personalities like, who was that one that died, that Australian crocodile hunter?
Steve Irwin.
Pranamaya. Look at this crocodile. Beautiful. Have a go at this. Crikey. So, you know, that love of life, life symptoms, is pranamaya. Yeah. And then above that, you have manomaya, or sometimes called jnanamaya, where there is appreciation of, you know, one's mind. Or the mind of others, as I was discussing the other day, that you know, scientists are investigating the minds of dolphins, and they are saying that dolphins, some dolphins are as intelligent as humans, and I was saying that's because the person who said that is as dumb as an animal. So. So, you know, so people appreciate, you know, the mind. Of course, the mind is also feelings. You know, quite often in this world, people take their emotion, the emotional side, that is the reality. Right? I'm in love. You know, there's so much. You know, mixed emotions and attachment and lust and everything thrown in, and it's somehow churned out as love, or something, you know, like that. And but these emotions and thoughts are taken as that is the real spiritual, you know, that's spiritual. As I've given the example sometimes that, you know, in America. Those who do rapping, you know, they sing and they rap, you know, gangster rap or this sort of rap. They take that as spiritual because it's coming from within. It's coming from the mind. It's coming from the heart. So that is the supreme reality, you know, more real and more important than the other features, pranamaya, manamaya. But actually, they're all material. And as long as even the jnanamaya, understanding that one is a spirit soul, literally up until about that point, it's really the crossroads, one is actually in conditioned life. From the point of vijnanamaya to anandamaya, one enters into transcendental life. Vijnanamaya, one appreciates that my spirit self and the spiritual nature of others is
different from the material mind, different from the life symptoms which are manifest, you know, by fueling the body with certain types of fuel and air and what have you. They appreciate that the life force, the very self, is actually different from all those. So that is Vijnana Maya. And above that is when one appreciates the Paramatma, then one approaches Anandamaya. But the Paramatma feature, of course, is just as Krishna describes in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, is just a small, you know, particle of Krishna's glory. So the supreme Anandamaya is Sri Krishna, and this is described Rasa Vaisa, that Krishna is the embodiment of the full embodiment of transcendental divine nectar. So they're the various features of they're all actually different manifestations of Brahman, from the material manifestation, whatever our whatever our reality is, that reality is actually another feature of Brahman manifested in those five different ways. But because the Vedas are so kind to point out reality beyond what we're aware of, but after hearing that, we tend to want to go for the highest, or go for something better than to rise above our circumstances. Just like Srila Prabhupada gives the example that if you take a vulture, they can see for maybe about 7 miles. They have this vision, this eyesight that is just incredible. Same polar bears, they can smell something, miles and miles away. It's just a little baby seal or something, they'll smell it. But the vultures, they have this incredible vision. But what do they do with that eyesight? They're just looking, where is dead corpse? Where is a dead body? Like that. Yeah. So the Vedas are directing us like that. You are an eternal spirit soul whose birthright, by your very real identity, is to live in the spiritual realm of eternality, full knowledge and bliss, and yet you're utilizing the nature of the spirit soul, which is more powerful than so many suns. Now we look at the sun in the sky, it's so powerful. The spirit soul, although so tiny, is more powerful than many, many suns. We utilize the energy of the soul in the same way that the vulture uses their brilliant eyesight just looking for dead corpses. So the Vedas are directing us that it is you're not taking full advantage of the opportunities that are available to you. So therefore they're pointing out these five different features of Brahman, of which they're saying, aim for the lotus feet of the Lord. That is the ultimate aim. That is where the highest manifestation of reality is. That is where the highest manifestation of divine, ecstatic, eternal bliss lies, at the lotus feet of the Lord. So that is a summary of that purport. Now I'll give you a summary of verse 18. I read the translation. Among the followers of the method set forth by great sages, those with less refined vision worship the Supreme as present in the region of the abdomen, while the Arunis worship him present in the heart, in the subtle centre from which all the pranic channels emanate. From there, O unlimited Lord, those worshippers raise their consciousness upward to the top of the head, where they can perceive you directly. Then, passing through the top of the head toward the supreme destination, they reach that place from which they will never again fall to this world into the mouth of death. So, I'll summarise that purport for you, since we don't have time to read it. And here, you see that here is describing that. Now, because, as we see, people do not take full advantage of their spiritual nature and the opportunity and the methods given in the Vedas to achieve eternal blissful life. Others desire something less. Now, among those who are more elevated, of course, than those on the Anamaya, you know, Pranamaya, Jnanamaya, and even the those platforms generally are the yogis. But here it describes that some yogis from the very beginning, because as you can imagine, some yogis are very elevated and are actually situated more on the Anandamaya platform of a yogi, where other yogis are actually just coming from the Anamaya platform and practicing yogi, literally taking their material body as worshipable. And you see that with many people, especially in this day and age, they practice yoga and they're meditating upon the body as the self. And the life airs within the body, there is the prana or the life airs, and the consciousness can be situated, directed towards a particular aspect, as we describe. So for those whose consciousness is on that Anamaya platform, it is still within this these chakras. You know, there are chakras from one at the base of the spine, one here, one on the chest. They are called the Muladhara chakra. There's a Svadhisthana chakra on the navel, and the Manipura chakra in the abdomen. So they're meditating, trying to meditate upon the super soul. Of course, on that level, they don't actually perceive the super soul, but they're perceiving the secondary symptoms of the presence of the super soul. And they're perceiving those symptoms in these base chakras. And we know from the Bhagavad Gita that there is a deity called Vaishvanara, who is a manifestation of the super soul. It's described in 15:14 that Krishna says, "I am the fire of digestion." "I am the fire of digestion" means that an aspect of the super soul, as Vaishvanara, resides within that part of the body and enables us to digest our food. And from the digestion of that food, so as we know, the yogis, they become very health conscious, very, very diet conscious, very very much concerned with how the body is operating, you know, as a fine-tuned machine. Some of the yogis, I've heard, they can actually, you know, remove their intestines through their anus and they can clean it out. You know, watch how they do. They're very, you know. So, it's a way of doing a colonic clean out, whatever it is. So, but they understand that because Vaishvanara is there, as the presence of the super soul is digesting the food and
giving the body so much energy. So the yogis, even though they don't eat so much, they have so much energy, so much power, which is coming from the this Vaishnava deity. So because the Lord, he is actually situated everywhere, even within the belly, the Lord is everywhere. And of course, Vaishnavas, we appreciate the presence of the Lord everywhere, and our recognition of this is that we mark our body with the 13 different markings of Tilak, in the beginning from the forehead, Om Keshavaya. So there we mark that here is the temple of Keshava. Om Keshavaya, Om Narayana. Here is the temple of Narayan. Om Madhavaya. Like that. Of the different temples. Up to Vasudeva, Om Vasudevaya Namaha, on the Brahmarodram. So the Vaishnava is also recognizing that the Lord is everywhere and that he is situated in various temples on the body. It's described here. Those yogis on that level, it's considered that their consciousness or their vision is clouded with dust. It's like they've got dust in their eyes. They're not considered very intelligent, even though they're yogis. They're still really on the bodily platform of life. Their appreciation of the super soul, although they're meditating on the super soul, for many of them, they don't really understand what the super soul is. They don't really understand what Brahman is properly. some of them are even directed, even on that platform, to meditate upon the Vishvarupa, or the universal form, because they really can't conceive of a personal form of God situated anywhere. above them it describes here, the Arunis, they worship him as present in the heart, in the subtle centre from which all the pranic channels emanate. So of course they are more on the platform of Jnanamaya and Vijnanamaya, and as described in 15.15, that the Lord describes in the very next sloka that I am situated within the heart of all living entities. So there is also a feature of this Paramatma, and his presence is felt through knowledge and practical intelligence, which is being channeled through the heart. So yogis on a higher level are deriving that knowledge and intelligence through the Paramatma, and they're on more on that platform of Vijnanamaya. Now, it describes it from there, O unlimited Lord, these worshippers, they raise their consciousness upward to the top of the head where they can perceive you directly. Then passing through the top of the head toward the supreme destination, they reach that place from which they will never again fall into this world, into the mouth of death. So we discuss this, of course, in the Bhakti Shastri in chapter number 8, that some yogis, I think it's described in verses 12, 13 of the 8th chapter, that if a yogi places the life air in the Agni chakra and then gradually raises it to the head while meditating upon the Supreme Lord and chanting the sacred syllable Om, they can actually attain the supreme destination. And for those yogis who are on that platform, they are able to choose a time in which they can leave their body during the light and when the sun travels in the north, and the various demigods that are in charge of the universe, they allow passage to those personalities, and they're able to go literally wherever they want. They can go to any planet. This is all described, of course, in Srila Prabhupada's Easy Journey to Other Planets. At that stage, they can actually go wherever they want. The problem is that
like everyone else, even yogis are still very attached to this material world. And therefore, some of them, even though they have the opportunity to meditate upon the Supreme Lord, it's not that they all take that opportunity. Some of them, therefore, want to go to the moon planet or, you know, like that. Srila Prabhupada actually, when he wrote the... it's actually a very interesting story. When he wrote that easy journey to other planets, he showed a librarian. He wrote that in 1958. And he showed a librarian the book, and the librarian looked at the book and he said, "Oh, so I can go to the moon?" Said the Prabhupada, "Yes, yes, this book is teaching you here." And he said, "And then I will come back." Said the Prabhupada, said, "No, no, you'll stay there." He said, "Oh, well, I won't go." Yeah. So, you know, that stuck in Srila Prabhupada's mind, and he always quoted that. He used to always quote. And previously, about a couple of years before that, the Russians went, you know, up into orbit in a Sputnik, whatever they call it. And when they were up there, there were the headlines in the newspapers that even though they were up, you know, way up there in space, they were just looking, "Oh, where is my Moscow? Where is my Moscow?" Like that. So like the vulture, you know, there's opportunity. There was another occasion where there were some astronauts that went on the supposed moon mission. It never really happened. And they started to believe in God and what have you, or because they said that they got a taste of the infinite while they're up there, and Srila Prabhupada said they could have done that from here. But anyway, the point being that they become attached, even though they're so elevated, they're just attached to, you know, Moscow or you know, this or that. They don't, you know, they could go to the moon and enjoy, you know, where each day is worth 6 months of our time and each night is worth 6 months of our time. So that's, you know, one day and night is 1 year of our time, and they live for 10,000 years. So that's the timing of the demigods, and they live for 10,000 years of the demigods on the moon planet. So, but because they're attached, and the same with Lord Indra. You know, one time Lord Indra was cursed to become a hog. And when Lord Brahma said, "Well, now the curse is over, you know, now you can go back to Brahma Loka, the topmost planet in the universe." "Oh, no, no. I have my wife, I have my children." So, although the yogis have this opportunity, don't think that they all take it, because like everyone in the material world, we become attached. Even though there are so many descriptions of Goloka Vrindavan, no one wants to go there. They just want to stay, you know, "Let me stay in, you know, Brunswick, let me stay in, you know, Collingwood," or, you know, "Let me remain in Eskimo, you know, in the freezing cold of, you know, where do they live?" And, you know, the people live in hellish places on this planet. But if you say to them, "Oh, come and live," "Oh, no, no." You know, they become attached. So anyway, in Easy Journey to Other Planets, Srila Prabhupada describes how through bhakti yoga you can actually, by the grace of the Guru and Krishna in this life, we are actually, just as a yogi, when they're perfect, they will go to anywhere they like, but the bhakti, the pure devotees, they're being trained in Krishna consciousness so that they will transmigrate to associate with Krishna in their next life. That is the benediction that Srila Prabhupada is giving us. And he describes it going to the moon planet. It is a childish, affair. So he described that in his book Easy Journey to Other Planets. That he was saying they will never be successful. According to the Vedic conception, to go to the moon, you actually have to be qualified by pious activities, and you have to have a certain type of body and what have you in order to get there. So Srila Prabhupada is always just stuck with the Vedic version that, you know, it is not possible for you to go to the moon. So of course, after whenever they would when Prabhupada was in America and they were asking him, just as they were about to go to the moon, Srila Prabhupada, he would say, I have said this many years ago in my easy journey to other planets. It is a childish affair, and it will it will not be successful. And then after they went to the moon, he still said the same thing. You know, I've written this in easy journey to other planets. And then after billions of dollars were spent, they've been to the moon, you know, although it is offering this beautiful cooling rays, they say it is all rocks and sand, and they brought back, you know, a couple of, you know, handfuls of rocks and sand for their billions and billions of dollars. And then they decided there's no value to it, so they scrapped that mission. And they asked Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Prabhupada said, yes, I have said that, an easy journey to other planets. It is a childless affair, and it will not, you know, it will not be successful. So Srila Prabhupada always stuck to that. So anyway, one day in 1976, Srila Prabhupada was walking with Hari Suri. He was on New Vrindavan farm. And he said the same thing to Hari Suri. And he said, so you've read that? And Hari Suri said, oh, I can't remember reading that. So Prabhupada looked at him, thought, and he said, bring me the book. So Hari Suri brought him the book, and Prabhupada spent a couple of days and he read that book. And he found out when he read it that that sentence had been edited out by Hayagriva. So he called Hayagriva in. He said, you have edited out my statement. And Hayagriva said, yes, Prabhupada, because you wrote that before they went to the moon. So Prabhupada, of course he was really angry with Hayagriva. He said, that means I cannot trust you. And Hayagriva was trying to convince Srila Prabhupada that if you leave that in the book, had you left that in the book, people would not take your book seriously. You know, they'll accept the scientists, but they won't accept your opinion. So anyway, Tamal Krishna, later, because Hayagriva was unrepentant, he thought, you know, I'm in the right, Srila Prabhupada's done the wrong thing, I've done him a favour. So Tamal Krishna chastised him severely. And finally he kept, you know, just trying to go along with the same excuse. Anyway, finally he broke down, he understood he'd done the wrong thing. And he went into Srila Prabhupada crying, Prabhupada, you know, I'm so sorry, forgive me. So Srila Prabhupada said that he forgave him, but he said, you have to fix it. So you have to, you know, we have to notify the BBT and we have to re-edit that book and put that statement back in there. Like that. And, you know, he was quite angry at him because that he was taking these statements, you know, he said, you're taking the statements of the spiritual master that I am an ordinary man and that these are just ordinary words, you know, although they're based upon the Vedic statements. So there was another devotee also, Purushottam, and in England, and he also, when they supposedly landed on the moon, he started to have serious doubts about Srila Prabhupada. And instead of, like Arjuna had some doubts, and instead of approaching Srila Prabhupada and saying, you know, I have doubts, he just brooded upon them, and gradually he couldn't do his service anymore and he left. So these statements are there in the Vedas, and they're given without change, you know, by the Acharyas, that the yogis, you know, Prabhupada, he was describing that, you know, when they were going to go to the moon, everyone was, you know, claiming, oh, the first steps on the moon. And Srila Prabhupada said, no.
You know, devotees have been, you know, known about moon excursions for so many, you know, long, long time. You know, yogis have been coming, you know, going to the moon, and then when their credit is used up, coming back for so long. They're not the first steps. They're not the first steps on the moon. So the fact is that people can go to these various planets by yogic processes. As easy as we walk down the street and get ourselves a, you know, go into the shop, grab ourselves a drink, it is that easy for a yogi who have perfected themselves. They can actually travel to any planet they want. But apart from the yogis and those who have qualified, we hear in the Bhagavad Gita also that those who do not qualify to go to the spiritual world where they never return, they leave this world at the different time, you know, when the sun travels in the south and, you know, what have you, in the dark fortnight. They go to the moon planet, but of course when their pious credits are used up, they come back to this world. So it is possible to go there, but under certain circumstances, when one is qualified by yogic process or by pious activity, by which one is then awarded a particular type of body to exist in those atmospheres, and the demigods you know, allow entrance into those particular places. But here, although these things are being described, this verse is describing these in such a way that yes, you can go here, you can do this, but as we go through these verses, we will see they're saying, but don't bother with all that. Don't take this really hard road of you know, yoga or trying to develop pious activities or jnana or what have you. Just by bhakti yoga in one stroke, again described in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the very last verse, that by bhakti yoga you can achieve the results of all these different processes. You can achieve what the jnanis get, what the karmis get, what the yogis get, the bhakti yogi, by just chanting Hare Krishna, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, eating Krishna Prasad, doing some service. They get the results that these get, but more, none of those other people can go to the spirit Kaloka Vrindavan. Here, these yogis here, unless, although they can go to Vaikuntha, but unless they become Ananya Bhaktas, they cannot go to Goloka Vrindavan. That is described in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. But the devotees, not only can they go anywhere that these people can go, get that result, but more, they can go to Goloka Vrindavan, the highest planet, the spiritual planet where Krishna resides. And what's more, they get that topmost goal by doing the most easiest and simple process, you know, so little austerity. Some devotees, you know, find, oh, it's so hard sometimes to be a devotee, but, you know, our austerities are so little compared to the, you know, what the Vedas are recommending to get to these other lesser places. So we've really got a good bargain, and that's what we should remember. And that's, of course, as we go through these prayers of the prayers of the personified Vedas, we should understand we have the opportunity that in the most easiest fashion, the most unqualified people can go to the topmost destination. That is the mercy being offered by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to those who chant Hare Krishna, somehow join in on the Sankirtan and take Krishna Prasadam. Don't be like the vulture that, you know, you have such prowess and use it for such a miserly activity. We have to be like our Mahatma sitting up the back there, always overseeing, broad-minded, always thinking of Krishna, not Juratma. Juratma means cripple-minded. We can't be cripple-minded like the vulture. We have to be broad-minded like our Mahatma up there. So does anyone have any quick questions or comments? Yes?
Prabhuji, Is there any way of going to Gosaka Vrindavan from there? Or?
Yeah, it is possible.
But spiritual world is spiritual. But then why there is difference between Vaikuntha and Gosaka Vrindavan?
Spiritual world is full of variety. Spiritual world is full of variety.
I don't know if you've seen Anjali Goswami's website.
Yeah.
I haven't. The whole thing about editing Prabhupada's work.
Okay.
Women had petitioned the BBT to remove the of
Prabhupada. Oh, okay. Right. Right.
Proof that come up very harshly, but particularly in this case, it was, and the BBT and the side of knowing world. They're very sympathetic, and they think it's not the Greek world. Makes it difficult to preach, but women are just one group.
Right. Well, I imagine what women can do is to write some books based upon Srila Prabhupada's books in which they do not change what Srila Prabhupada has said, but they couch it in such a way that it is actually attractive to women. See, when Srila Prabhupada wrote Easy Journey to Other Planets, the reason he wrote that was because two American scientists they got a Nobel Prize, so there was an article he read for discovering antimatter or an antiproton. So Srila Prabhupada, even though he knew that they were talking about matter, something material, he took the terminology antimatter and used it to then describe the verses of the Bhagavad Gita, especially the second chapter and eighth chapter, and he wrote a book using such scientific terms that they were using, but in such a way that, these are the terms they like, they're very popular, antimatter, proton, all like. So he substituted those words for the same words of the Bhagavad Gita without changing the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita, and in that way this book still has this universal appeal that makes devotees all over the world. So, you see what I mean? Srila Prabhupada didn't change the message of the Bhagavad Gita or the teachings of the Vedas, but he did use popular words or sentiments in such a way that it became very attractive. So, women can, I imagine that someone should do that. They should write a book based upon Bhagavad Gita, based upon Prabhupada's teachings, but just without changing the teachings, present in such a way that is very, very appealing to the women, and so that they can get over some of the obstacles of some of the terminology, what have you. Yes. Yep. That's a good point.
What we know actually, they were on high position, they were really rulers, and they say what we don't know anything.
So some of those things should go in the book. That's a good point. One more point is that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura also, when he wrote Sri Krishna Samhita, in the beginning of Sri Krishna Samhita, he gives the history of the Vedas according to the Westerners. So the Westerners have a whole history of the Vedas which is completely different to ours. So he sort of, so that they would read his book, he sort of really left their history as it was, but then with some slight changes, but then presented all the Vedic ideas into that history. So he sort of carefully left out certain points of contention, and put in some things to think that they're basically reading their, what they agree with. Some of the and Srila Prabhupada sometimes says that. Sometimes when he speaks about the moon, he'll speak of it in terms of the Vedas, that it is such and such a distance away. But then sometimes, according to who he's preaching to, he'll speak to the moon according to the distance that the materialists think it is from us. So, you know, in other words, if you think they say it is such and such a way, but then they'll listen to him because he hasn't said something that they're going to immediately disagree with. But it's not the distance that's the point, but then he'll get his philosophical point in, which they're happy to listen to, because they haven't been, they haven't had that obstacle of him quoting a number which they immediately disagree with. Therefore, anything you'd say after that, they won't hear. So, I have seen different people read, you know, and sometimes with the women, of course, they would get this very early on in some books. You know, there are some statements, and you know it's going to be a stumbling block, and then everything after that statement is unacceptable. So we have to, if we can somehow present the literature, subsidiary literatures, in such a way that people can get over that stumbling block, and yet the message is unchanged, and that is a great service. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, that's good. All right. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.